very good. Yes, sir. Thank you there, Mr. Luke. All right. Turn with me, if you would, to Romans chapter 13. Years ago, Thomas Paine wrote these words. He said, "These are the times that try men's souls." What do you mean by that? It meant we were living in a time where everything's changing, and men have to sit and look at their allegiances, what they believe in, what truly is important. You know, there's been revolutions all over the world. They happen all the time. South America, they'll have revolutions every 20, 30 years. People die, and nothing ever changes. You say, why? Why is it that Africa, Europe, all these places will have these revolutions, Asia, nothing ever changes? And there was a time when people thought, well, it's because we're white people. Well, we've learned that's pretty stupid. Okay? We found that people from other lands can come here and live under our laws and flourish and make it better. We've learned that. We've learned that people of our race can go live under those countries, be as crummy as they are. It has nothing to do with what race you are. Instead, it has to do that we live under a system of laws. Now, they're not always good laws, but we live under a system of laws and we've agreed to live under. Now, here's what made the American Revolution different. A, the people who fought in it had a King James Bible in their home. Chances are they had two books in their home. One would have been a King James Bible, the other would have been Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. Those were the two most common books in a colonial household. Now, once we went on and began to settle the prairies and such in the early 1800s, you could add the McGuffey readers to that. Those would have been there. But there was something different about taking a poor, oppressed people and them actually knowing what God thought. The problem with the average peasant in South America, Poland, Asia today, they don't know what God thinks. There's no bottom line right and wrong. Now imagine John Mark works building things. He has codes that he has to follow. Now imagine if tomorrow morning when they get to work, they have a conference because the foot has now been changed to 13 inches. A pound is no longer 16 ounces, it's 17 and a half ounces. Okay? Would that wreak confusion? Sure it would. Wreak a lot of confusion. Now, for example, just so you understand, that's what goes on in the financial markets today. Every week a banker's called, told what his money's worth. And it's wrought unbelievable confusion for the last 40 years, ever since Richard Nixon brought that into the United States. It's wrought unbelievable confusion. But regardless of that, it's what's done in the moral world. Or what was moral, for example, take anyone in leadership in Washington today, look at their statements 20 years ago on sodomite marriage, sodomites in the military, and look at their statements today. They change. They say, well, we became more mature. No, you want to stay in office. You've changed with the times. If that's maturity, then that's maturity. But other mature things they don't do if it won't keep them in office. Okay, we know that. It's a matter of changing with the times. So what happens when you have a populace who they themselves know what the standard is? They themselves know what the laws are. They themselves know what God thinks. Well, if you've got a group of farmers like that standing holding a bridge, chances are any shot they fire will be heard around the world. Okay? It's a shot that's never going to stop because they know what they stand for. And if should they have absolutely been defeated and all put in jail, it wouldn't have changed their minds as far as what they believed. When they conquered, it didn't change their minds as far as what they believed. So what I want to do is this. I want to go into a little bit here today and try to begin to give you some basics from the Word of God. What the Word of God says about things like government. Okay? So in Romans chapter 13, we get a New Testament primer. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Now, who was the leader when Paul wrote that? A man by the name of Nero. Okay? Nero was a wicked man, an evil man. He slept with his own mother. He loved torture. He was a vile man in every way that you could say. And yet Paul said he couldn't be there if God hadn't put him there. Okay. When Jesus Christ talked to Pontius Pilate, Pilate said, "Don't you know I had the power to crucify you?" Now imagine having a job like a governor in a Roman province, and a man's being brought in to be judged by you. And there's a high possibility that you'll end up having him crucified because he has passed law. He has broken laws that it demands he be crucified. And let's say you have any experience whatsoever. How do you think men have come in before? Probably groveling and begging you. Just absolutely begging you for mercy. And in walks a man who won't answer at all. And it says Pilate marveled at that man. Marveled. Finally says, "Don't you know I had the power to crucify you?" And Jesus Christ said this, "You could have no power over me at all except my Father gave it to you. That's why you have the power." And then just silent again. Well, they say you're king. Well, thou sayest. Okay? That's all there is to it. The point to that is the same point that's here. If a man's in power, it's because God put him there. Now, you'll find exceptions to that. You'll find places, for example, in the book of Judges, there's a point where a man by the name of Abimelech takes over. And when God counts the timetable of the book of Judges, he counts the timetable. At one point, Paul says, "And from Samuel unto Saul is this amount of time." Actually, he says, "From the book of Judges, from Joshua to Saul is this amount of time." He does not count the time that Abimelech's ruling. You go back and count it. Because Abimelech was an usurper. He wasn't really the one in charge. He took it by just violence. How do you know the difference? How do you know the difference when a tyrant like Nero really is in charge and God put him there, and someone like Abimelech in the book of Judges isn't even counted by God as a real ruler? How do you count that? You know, Abraham Lincoln, when it came time for the Civil War, would never address the Confederates as a real government. You know, I said, those people. Certain elements in the South. He never, ever, at one point they wanted to have a meeting between John Stevens and the Vice President of the United States. John Stevens, if I remember right, was the Vice President of the Confederacy. And Lincoln finally agreed, as long as it was done on a personal level. At no point do we recognize that as being anything. It's nothing. It has no legal standing. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, and which every state has ratified, says that no Confederate law means anything. It can never be recognized. It's nothing. Okay? Well, I know another thing. Lincoln was right. I'll go into that another time if you want to go into it. But it just goes into, how do you know when a government is of God and a government is not of God? How could you recognize it? Well, I want to give you some principles here. I don't know if any of you are going to have this all totally figured out at the end of this time. But verse 2 says there, "Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive themselves damnation." Now, I've sat in a jail cell, been brought into court, and had some idiot read that to me. Tell me, this is why you ought to obey this law. You're wrong, preacher. And you have to explain to him the highest power in the United States of America is the Constitution of the United States of America. That's the highest power. It's not the president. It's not the Congress. It's the Constitution of the United States of America. And anybody passing a law contrary to the Constitution of the United States of America, I have absolutely zero obligation to obey it. And you want to know something else? The Supreme Court of the United States said that. When you're confronted by a law that is in violation of the Constitution, you have zero obligation to obey that law. Now you're going to pay a price. It's not going to be there, but he's run up, with, you know, hugs you and calls you wonderful and that kind of stuff. You'll pay a price for it, okay? My name is on two federal court cases where I've paid a price. You know, this is what you've got to do if you think something's wrong. And did I suffer? Well, I got three meals and sat in a pretty nice air-conditioned jail cell or whatever else. I wouldn't even begin to consider what I did paying a price, okay? Considering some of the people who paid price over the years. First thing is having to recognize what is the highest power in a land. I understand the highest power is God. But God has always used human instruments to rule on this earth. One of the things that makes our country different is that we are ruled by a constitution, by a series of laws. When I tell people that I'm patriotic, I want to separate that from the word nationalistic. I did a series of editorials in South Carolina between 1999 and 2001. And I was an opponent of the Confederate flag. I wanted it taken off the State House. Okay, for one thing, it was a violation of the 14th Amendment. I was the only white, conservative, male, Republican on that side. Okay, and I was constantly attacked by the liberals. I had an Irish newspaper reporter call me one time and said, Mr. Asquith, we want to know why a racist is against the Confederate flag. A racist? Well, we understand you're a Republican, you know, and I mean that. I mean, some of the guy by the name of Brett Bursey, an old hippie, called him and told him a racist was on their side and such. But again, you have to put up with that kind of thing. You have to, you know, in other words, if you're going to stand for what's right, you're going to have that kind of thing happen. But in that series of editorials, I wanted people to understand the difference between two different words. One of them is nationalism, the other is patriotism. Now, if you were to live in, say, Eastern Europe, a Bosnian and a Serb, who both speak the same language, but they write it with different alphabets. A lot of people don't realize that. Bosnian and Serbian languages are exactly the same. But if you grow up Serbian, you write it with the Russian Cyrillic alphabet. If you grow up Bosnian, you write it with the Roman alphabet. If you're a Serbian, you make the sign of the cross with two fingers. If you're a Bosnian, you make it with three fingers. That's why when the Bosnians killed the Serbs, or the Serbs killed the Bosnians, they cut a finger off. Okay? You want them to know you're wrong for doing this. And you say, well, what is that? Is that based on laws and what's right and wrong? No, it's based on a nationalism, the idea our people are better than your people. Okay? I don't love the United States of America because of its rocks and rills and the majesty of its flag and its mountains and how wonderful we are. I love it because we are a system of laws, a system of constitutional justice. That no matter who comes to this country, no matter what nation they're from, no matter what their ethnic heritage is, no matter what they look like, that they flourish under these laws, and when they stand before a court, that they are to be treated absolutely equal, and I'll die for that system of laws. Jim and I have sworn an oath to uphold those. We'll uphold those. But the idea just because I'm an American, my country right or wrong, I don't believe that. My country's wrong, it's wrong. It's right, it's right. I'm not going to dump it over little things it does wrong. And where I would dump my wife over little things she does wrong, all right? I'm not sure it's vice versa. I have to walk a pretty tight line, but it's just that idea that to be a patriot is someone who loves the constitutional order of this country. To be a patriot, going all the way back in English history, was to be someone who recognized the laws of their country. When a king broke them, they're against the king. When the parliament broke them, they're against the parliament. And when a criminal broke them, they're against the criminal. It's a series of laws. And when the laws are bad, you work within a process to change those laws. And they're not going to be changed instantly. It's never going to be made perfect. But it's a system worth dying for. But the idea just because we're Americans and America's the best, I don't believe that. And yet I do believe we're the best country. I believe that the United States of America is the single greatest work of welfare that God ever did for the poor of the world. I believe that. I believe the greatest gift that God ever gave to the poor of this world. Do you realize on the Statue of Liberty, there's a thing that says, give me your tired and your poor. Your humbled masses yearning to be free. Send these, the homeless tempest, tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden shore. I've heard the stories of those GIs coming back from Europe and standing on the ship and seeing that Statue of Liberty and the weeping. They seen what was going on in Europe. They saw what was going on. The sons of Italians and Poles and Serbs and the sons of Spaniards and the sons of Africans and the sons of these people. And they came to this country. And it's not that everything's suddenly wonderful, but it's the idea that when they work, they get to keep their own money. When they have their families at home, they can teach their families how they want to. I hear a lot of nonsense today. People, English only, English only. I don't believe that. Now, why? Do you realize when William McKinley ran for president, 1896, that when he said he was going to run, he had to publish it in 12 different languages in the major newspapers? If he wanted everybody to read it, he had to put it in the German papers. He had to put it in the Spanish papers, the Yiddish papers, the Polish papers, and he had to put it. Then why did English end up winning? It won in what's called the market. It's the easiest language to work with for transactions and everything else. That's what it's for. And the whole idea is, I don't want to coddle and baby other languages. You know, you go get your food stamps and get to pick through 82 different languages what language you want your food stamps in. I'm not for that. But neither would I ever make a law English only. If English is good, let it win. Let it win in a free market. If our culture is going to win, let it win in a free market. Now I take Stephen and Samantha, sit next to each other. Stephen represents the gringo, the Caucasians. You know what the average age of a Caucasian is in the United States of America? 56 years old. Samantha represents the Hispanic. You know what the average age of an Hispanic is in the United States of America? 9 years old. Over the next 20 years, which culture is going to win? Hers is. You know what? They still have life. How come the Caucasians are? Because they've become a bunch of idiots, sterilizing themselves, aborting their babies, running around and doing all this. They're going to lose. And you know what? Let them lose. It doesn't bother me. It won't bother me if the Hispanics take over the United States of America, as long as they keep the laws. Fight for those things that are right, those principles, the Constitution, those things that make it what it is. That's what it needs to be. You fight for those principles, not for some idea of my ethnic heritage. I don't give a rip about my ethnic heritage. You know, I do in the sense when I'm home and let my kids know, gosh, your great-grandfather was hung for a sheep. This is our ethnic heritage or whatever. I mean, those are kind of fun things. But I'm not going to run my government based on that. I'm not going to run, I'm not going to go around and vote based on that. I'm going to vote based on how is the best way for a man to keep his wages, run his home the way he wants to, educate his children the way he wants to, keep decent law and order in this country. What is the best way to do that? That's what I look for. Now it goes on and it says this, verse 3, for rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Now if you think about it, I understand you had different rulers from time to time who were a terror to good works, but the worst governor in any state of the union today doesn't arrest people for driving the speed limit. But in that state, if you go 65 and a 40, they're going to give you a ticket. They're going to get evil work. Okay? And you may say, he's a horrible governor. He's a vile person. But basically, in the law and order, they're punishing bad people. That's what the government's for. There's a tremendous book, if you're interested in this kind of reading. Tim's got a copy of it. Every once in a while, he looks at it and thinks about reading it. But it's called The Law, written by a guy by the name of Bastiat. All right? He wrote it in 1848. And he wrote it after the Paris Commune and some things that went on at that period of time. And he wrote down what the law is for. What is the law for? And he said, government in law should never be to do good. If you give it the power to do good, it'll become evil. The government is there only to punish evil doers. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, I remember some years ago needing to sue somebody. And I was upset over that because I was a Christian. We needed to have a lawsuit. You know what my pastor told me? He said, John, the Bible does not say not to sue somebody. It says you don't sue your brother. Okay? That's my physical brother, shouldn't sue him. My brother in this church, I wouldn't sue him. If I had a problem in here that I felt that Chris owed me money or Chris has done wrong or something, and I'm real irritated about it, the honorable way to handle that within a church is when you get the elders, have them judge and abide by that judgment. Okay? Whether I agree with it or don't, abide by that. Don't drag church business into a court of law. But here's what my pastor said. He said this. He said, John, what you're upset about, he said, do you realize in any other country in the world already people would have shot each other? Already people would have gone burned each other's houses down. Why aren't we doing that in our country? Because as bad as our court system is, we have a court system. You go in there and a judge looks at it. And a judge makes a decision. And as a result, neighbors don't shoot each other. They're not burning each other's houses down. They're not having 30-year-long feuds with each other. And he said, it's that court system that's kept us civil. And as terrible as it is, it's better than every other court system in the world. It works, okay? So the whole idea is we live under a system of laws and we do this, and the rulers, they're not there to be a terror to good people. They're there to be a terror to bad people. People are doing things wrong. That's what they're for. And the moment the government says we'll start doing good things, then they build up, they become stronger, and after a while they become evil. Okay? That's where the principle is the smaller the government. All you want is it to have power to stop people from hurting each other. If it starts saying, well, I'll straighten everything out, I'll make everything good, you give it that kind of power, it'll be what humans have always done. They'll turn it to wickedness. It's what they've always done. One of the things that makes the Constitution of the United States different than all other governments is that it is based upon the principle that people are evil. All other governments are based on the principle that people are good. And then they do the most horrible things to each other. The most horrible people in the world are do-gooders. The do-gooders. This is so sad. Oh, we're going to do good. There's a guy I've listened to a few times. His name is Michael Medved. Michael Medved is not a Christian. He's a Jew. He's a film critic. So he's kind of a social liberal. He was Hillary Clinton's lab partner, if I remember, at Yale. Okay? It's kind of education he had. Today, he's a conservative. One of the few conservative film critics there are. And I heard somebody ask him one time, whatever turned you into a conservative? You're a Jew. Most Jews are liberals. You know, you went to Yale right off the bat, you probably had stamped liberal on your, you know, cortex or something. But the thing is, he said this. He said, you know, when he got out of college and he's all fresh with wonderful ideas and everything, and he went and he worked at different places as part of these internships. And he'd go into work someplace where it'd be an organization where they're helping crippled children. They're helping refugees. And he'd say, oh, these have to be wonderful people. He noticed that the people in charge of that who go to the cocktails and we're helping the little people and making their cocktails. And he noticed that they were the most impersonal, cruel people he had ever dealt with in his life. Who didn't care if his arm was broken. They didn't care if his wife was sick. They didn't care anything. All they just talked about, oh, we're helping and such. But personally, on a one-on-one level, they were horrible people to work for. And then he had to go work for a bank where he heard this one banker was a top conservative and such, and he was just trembling. He said that man every day cared about his welfare. Every day that man cared about his family. Every day that man cared. But when it came to the overall things, he had this idea of a small government and people taking care of themselves and such. And he said slowly his eyes became open to what reality really was. That the liberal movement's making the government bigger is a bunch of people whose consciences are bad because they live horrible, sinful, vile lives, and they want the government to do the good because they're incapable of doing it themselves. So they build the government big to do good because they can't do good. The most conservative state in the United States of America, without any shadow of a doubt, hands down, is Utah. I've lived in Utah. Second most conservative state is South Carolina. I've lived there. By the way, you know what number state, you know what state is number one and two in personal giving as percentage? Is Utah and South Carolina. If you look at IRS, what people deduct for their personal charity and their giving, number one state is Utah. Number two state is South Carolina. You know what the most liberal states of the Union are? New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, California, Massachusetts. Oh, by the way, which states give the absolute least personally of their own money? Those states. See, they try to pass it all on to the government to do the good because they as individuals don't want to do that. They don't want to do it at all. Now, verse 3 again. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. And I've found this, whether I live in a liberal state or a conservative state, if you do good, you know, the cops are on there like you, and the government people like you, if you do good. Verse 4. For he is a minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For is the minister of God a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil? Now listen to me on this and listen carefully. In that Old Testament, if Chris was to find out that a close family member of his was killed in the Old Testament, whose responsibility was it to see to it that the murderer was brought to justice? Chris's responsibility. So much so that God made Israel eventually establish six cities that if you accidentally killed somebody, the example was given, you have an axe, you pull back, the head comes off and kills the guy behind you. All Chris hears is that I killed his brother with an axe. Okay? So he's hot for me. I'm to run to the city of refuge and tell the elders I have accidentally killed a man. They then have me in protective custody. Chris comes, and there is a trial. And they find out. You want to know one of the rules is? If it's testified that I hated that man before time, I'm a murderer right off the bat. They don't care what the rest of the circumstances are. They already know you hated that man, it's over. Well, it says in 1 John, if you hate a man, you're murdered. Okay? But it was found out I didn't hate him. I didn't lay in wait for him. This is something where it really was manslaughter, an accident. And they tell Chris, he lives without in our city, you're not to touch him, go on. And then they tell me, by the way, you have to stay in this city until the death of the high priest. Okay? That's just the added time thing. What if he's a young man? You're gonna be here a long time, brother. Okay? What if he's an old man? You're gonna get out pretty soon. But when they let you out of that city, because the high priest died, now if Chris kills me, he's a murderer. It's not revenge, it's a murder, okay? Because of what he did. So the thing is, how about the New Testament? No. It talks about the ruler beareth not the sword in vain. He is the revenger. It no longer is in personal hands in the New Testament. The government's job is to revenge wrong done. Now, do you say they always do it? No, it's actually gotten disgusting in this country. Okay? It's gotten disgusting. But it's still better than any other country. You know, it's like Winston Churchill said. He said the absolute worst form of, or he said, you know, I know what he said democracy in our form of government is terrible. It's just, it's better than every other form. All right? It's terrible, but it's better than every other form out there. And you can sit there and complain about it all day long. You know, I'll complain about my country. I'll complain about it all day long. I'll complain about my family. But if your family comes and attacks my family, I'm on our side. It's just the way we are, aren't we? You sit there and complain about your brothers and sisters, but don't let anybody else come into it. All right? You know, that's family stuff here. I mean, you know, that's Gracie and Autumn, they'll pull each other's hair and get mad and cry to their mother and that, but don't let the neighbor come there and try to do something. Then they'll band together. All right? They're sisters. Nobody's going to touch them. It's just the way it is. And it's that way with our country. I know there's a lot wrong with it. But when I see a state trooper get out of his car and he's got a pistol packed right here, he is a revenger. He's God's minister. That's what he's there for. Okay? I'm glad he packs that piece on him. I'm glad he practices with that thing. You know, one of the things going on in the United States of America today is this. The inner cities are absolutely falling apart because the police have withdrawn. It's called the Ferguson effect. The police have withdrawn.
The murder rates are going right up through the roof. Now, if you were a cop in another city, would you just walk in arbitrarily anymore? You wouldn't do it. You'd drag to jail if things go wrong. You're shot out of nowhere if things go wrong. I'll tell you one of the things I'd like to see the Sunday schools in this church do. I'd like to see the kids write some letters, maybe to the local trooper of merits, maybe to the Cuba police, and maybe to the Allegheny County deputies, and just tell them how much we appreciate them. And how much we can go to sleep in our beds at night because they're there, they're putting their lives on the line every single day. You see, when Neil goes and he's going to go and climb in his truck, and when Kyle goes and he's going to go off and either work with his brother or go there to Old Navy, or Chris goes off and get in his truck or something like that, I'm not saying it's 100% safe. But see, when that cop goes ahead, he puts that uniform on, he puts that badge on, he straps that gun around himself, that wife has to wonder every single day, will he come back? Will this be the day that he takes the bullet? Is this the day that he goes down for somebody that's just going to call him a pig anyway and laugh about him and all that kind of stuff? Is this the day he's going to do it? Now, I'll tell you something. Some 28 years ago, I was preaching on a college campus in Lindenville, Vermont. I used to go out to the local college campus there and preach some of the students where they'd hang out in the big open field. And things were going there for a while, and then some students decided they didn't like that. Now, I'm not near their dorms. I'm not near anywhere like that. This is a big open field. And I literally had stood and had a wall of variances pointed at me, people leaning over, and people chanting and screaming, and had the cops walk up and say, "You're disorderly. You happen to notice all the one-eyed guys looking at you over here?" You know? And, you know, "You're the one that's disorderly." And I'll never forget Sergeant Gray of the Vermont State Troopers being called out. An official from the college comes up and said, "That's the problem," and he points to me. I said, "Sergeant Gray, this is public land. I'm not anywhere near the sleeping quarters. No one has to be here. They gathered because I am here. Okay? I'm not interrupting anything they're doing. Look at their chanting." But an official from the college says, "We told him he can't be here." As even the ACLU came out defending me on this one. But we told him he can't be here and such. And I'll never forget this old veteran of Vermont State Troopers House. Never forget him looking at me and saying, "I have to make a decision." And he said, "I'm not sure what to do." And then he came to me and he said, "I have made my decision, and my decision is that I am going to arrest you. And I want you to know this was not an easy decision." And I said, "Sergeant Gray," I said, "I know this wasn't easy. And I want you to know that when you put your uniform on this morning, you put your life on the line for me, and you put it on the line for my wife and my children." And I said, "I want you to know I will never blame you for what you're doing here. The laws will exonerate me for this." He said, "If they do, I will call you first and let you know that they have exonerated you." He gets in the car, he takes me in. Meanwhile, there was a lawyer in Newport, Vermont, 30 miles away. My name is Duncan Kilmartin, who was in charge of a nationwide conservative organization that dealt with laws and such. He'd heard about what was going on. He told me, he said, "If you ever get in trouble, would you please call me?" So I'm there in a Vermont jail, St. Johnsbury, and I call this number, this Duncan Kilmartin, this lawyer, big nationwide, goes into Washington, knows all the senators, everything else. And I said, "Mr. Kilmartin," I said, "I have been arrested." "Well, who arrested you?" I said, "Sergeant Gray." He was a little bit quiet. And I said, I explained to him the conversation between Sergeant Gray and myself. And Duncan said, "Tell me that again." I told him again. He said, "John, you don't know what you told that man." He said, "Just yesterday, that man stood in a court of law and had a jury let a man go who put a gun in his face and pulled it, and the gun misfired. And he arrested the man for attempted murder, and a jury let the man go. And he is so bitter that he cannot even see straight. He is so bitter because that man wanted him dead. And he says, today you have looked him in the face and told him that he has put his life on the line for you and your family, and thank you." He said, "Would you put Sergeant Gray on the phone for me?" I got Sergeant Gray on the phone and I just walked away. I saw Duncan dealing with him one-on-one. He'd been knowing Sergeant Gray for years. 2 days later, I got a phone call from Sergeant Gray saying, I just want you to know, he said, the state of Vermont has told me I was wrong. They've let you go to us. And Sergeant Gray, I still mean what I said. You're just in a hard position. He had to do something. He didn't know what to do. He told me that. I didn't live for that. I'm not angry with him over that. As it is, I think God got the glory for that. That's a hero. Every cop you see, I don't care if he's some stupid little punk, okay? That's probably gonna get his butt beat a few times because he's a stupid punk. He's a hero. He's put a gun on his side. He's put a badge on. He's made himself a target. He's out there working for wages you probably wouldn't work for. And I hope that this church and every child in this church has that in their head, and has that in their mind, and show them that kind of honor.
Some of you may have heard there's been more cops shot in the United States this morning or today. Baton Rouge, Louisiana, there are 3 cops down. Okay? And again, we live in times, those of you, Jim, Melinda, we lived through the 1960s. Remember these times. These aren't easy times. These are horrible times. I want you folks to keep your heads. I want you folks to remember where the true power really is. It's from our God, the Constitution of the United States. The goodness of our country isn't its people, it's its laws. It's the virtues we keep as a people. Okay? That's what makes a country good. And if we break those laws, if we take them down, if we chop them up, and we don't have respect for where the power is, we're not a good people anymore. Now, our country is pretty far down the road in the chastisement of God. One of the things God promises to do in the book of Ezekiel, you can write this down, sit down, go yourself, Ezekiel 20, 25, and 26. He promises that if a country goes bad, he will give them bad laws. He'll see to it they pass bad laws. Well, Neil, you think we're there? Yeah, I think we've made it. I think we have fully pulled in. We're sitting there. We have bad statutes and laws. You know what the next one is? You have to think about this a moment. He said, you'll burn your firstborn in the fire. That's right. Chris said it's done. You know when we're doing that? What do you think they do with all those fetuses? You think women are aborting their second and third child? No, it's that first one. Didn't mean to get pregnant yet. We're burning our firstborn in the fire. You go by and, it's a little bit of haze coming out of that chimney at the hospital there, a little bit, you can see where there's some heat there. That's their firstborn going up in the fire. You know what the next step is the sword. The sword. That's what God brings against a nation to chasten that nation is the sword. This country doesn't even know what that means. This country doesn't even have a clue. Oh, it's had a clue. Do you realize back around 1815, an Indian by the name of Tecumseh, the Shawnee out of Ohio, went down to the Cherokee of Georgia and said, do not trust the white man. You cannot trust them. You must confederate with us and you must band together with us. And the Cherokee explained to Tecumseh, no, we trust the white man. He'll never hurt us. We're not going to get with you. 10 years later, the white men put him on the Trail of Tears. They didn't kick him out of teepees. They kicked him out of plank houses. Houses with plantations and crops and farms. And the fact, just because they're an Indian and they're kicked out of there and they're set on the road and they're told to go and your grandma's falling in the snow and she's dying there of starvation and finally you get to Oklahoma and there's nothing and they tell you, go to Oklahoma sometime and then look along the hills of Tennessee and Georgia. Tell me it's the same, okay? It's called the Trail of Tears. What were the odds that one generation later, a Union general whose first name is Tecumseh Sherman would go to that same area and burn every single farm and burn every single house and slaughter every pig and every cow and burn every standing stalk of corn called Sherman's Ride of the Sea? You realize his first name was Tecumseh? See, God has a long memory and God remembers those things. And the sword has been in this country, but it's not too often and it doesn't happen too often.
but it's coming again. The first place is to break down all authority so that no one trusts authority. No one trusts that cop out there. No one trusts the soldiers. Nobody trusts that kind of thing. And then we turn on each other. And already, the inner cities of this country, the murder rate has gone through the roof in the last 2 years, what's called the Ferguson effect. And no cop's going to stand there and put his career on the line trying to keep you from murdering your brother. Okay? And I have a hard time blaming him for it. All I want is this, is the people from the Black Creek Baptist Church understand the difference between right and wrong. And understand that when that man puts a gun on his side, he is on God's side. Not your side, he's on God's side. He's there to keep law and order. And if he makes a mistake, he's human, just like you are. And if you happen to be the victim of that mistake, endure that mistake. Courts will straighten it out. There's a man I like to read behind by the name of David Horowitz. David Horowitz is a Jew. He was one of the Berkeley Radicals, the Berkeley Seven. And David Horowitz set up the Black Panther Party of the United States back in the 1960s and built their educational system. Today he's a top conservative. David Horowitz's father was a personal friend of Joseph Stalin's, who would fly to Russia and sit and eat with Stalin. Stalin called Americans like that useful idiots. That's what he called them. Called them useful idiots, the people who thought that he was really a good person. But the thing is, he was one of those. David Horowitz said this. He said, my father was an English teacher in a New York high school, and he was a good one, and he taught people to read and write. And he taught them to write well. And he said, the day came when the state fired him for being a communist, and he said the state was wrong for that. And he said, 7 years later, the Supreme Court of the state of New York reinstated his father, gave him back pay for 7 years, punitive damages for whatever happened. And he said, the sad part is, he said, had my father prevailed as a communist, no one would have ever been recompensed for disagreeing with the government. No one would have ever been recompensed. That never would have happened. He said, that's one of the ironies to live in the United States of America. You read behind David Horowitz, a very honorable man. We have a book on our Audible account, but you can get it sometime. It's called Radical Son. He talks about what it was to become a radical, become a conservative, and your dad's a top communist. It's a tremendous story. If you're pro-America, and I hope you are, but I don't want you pro-America because you love the Stars and Stripes. I don't want you pro-America because you get all goosebumply on the 4th of July. I want you pro-America because this is the best hope for poor people of the world to come and build a home and build a life. And even that's being threatened by breaking down the laws of how we bring poor people in, okay? There's a way, there's an orderly way to do it. I'm the most pro-immigrant man you will ever find. My family will tell you, when I go into a convenience store and that person is sitting there and they're from India or Pakistan or they're from some place like that, I ask them over and over again, where are you from? And they'll tell me, and they think I'm attacking them. I'll say, I am so glad you're here. I said, your children will make this a great country. And if you go look at the children of the immigrants, they make it a great country, okay? And they do that. I'm the most pro-immigrant man you will ever find. You won't find anybody more pro-immigrant. But if we break the laws to do it, and we crumble the laws and break them all down and break down the order, it won't work, okay? We're looking for the order of this country to be done because that's what we're fighting for. We're fighting for a constitutional order so that all men everywhere can come here and flourish. And you know what? If I come back in 100 years and everybody's doing the Watusi and African culture is taking over, if they win it in a fair fight, they won it in a fair fight. If our culture falls apart, it falls apart. Okay, I don't want our culture to win because we have guns. I want it to win because it has a constitutional order and there's some justice and a Bible behind it and real laws. But if anything the white people have done in this country in the last 40 years, they've thrown all that out, become some of the most despicable people on this earth. Let's close. Father, I thank you for what we've heard here today, and I do pray that you'd make our children be people who are a beacon of true hope.